Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, on the way tomorrow on our program, it's our annual pre-Thanksgiving special edition of What You Got Cookin'. John Shields of Gertrude's Restaurant, Damian Mosley of Black Sauce Kitchen, and Debonette Wyatt of My Mama's Vegan will join us with tips for turkey and all the fixins, or all the fixins without the turkey. You can make that call, and we do hope that you will call tomorrow to share your favorite recipes and Thanksgiving traditions. Now we turn our attention to two of Maryland's most prominent voices in the world of poetry. In a little bit, I'll speak with our state's poet laureate, Grace Cavalieri. But joining me now is Kondwani Fidel. Last year, he released his debut poetry EP, The Mud Was Made for Us. He's also the author of the nonfiction book, The Anti-Racist, How to Start the Conversation About Race and Take Action. And he's featured in a short film, Hummingbirds in the Trenches. He holds a master's degree in creative writing and publishing arts from the University of Baltimore. He's a professor at Coppin State University. He joins us from Baltimore on Zoom. Kondi, welcome. It's good to talk to you.
Hey, what's up, man? Thank you for having me. I'm honored.
I'm really glad to have you because I've followed your work for a long time, and this is the first time we've been able to have you on the show, so I'm glad it worked out. For folks who are not familiar with your work, it really comes from your personal experience growing up here in Baltimore. Talk about the seeds of inspiration for what you're writing about.
So majority of the inspiration just comes from, you know, my upbringing, me growing up in East Baltimore, you know, the trials and tribulations that I had to face, if it was, you know, losing friends to gun violence or the prison cells, or, you know, my mother and father, you know, battling with drug addiction, and them, you know, dealing, you know, with the, you know, the pain and the inequalities that come from, you know, mass incarceration. And, you know, that was, you know, what my earlier work was about, just like being just honest about these feelings, these emotions, you know, the mental, you know, health issues that I was dealing with as a child, you know, before I even knew what the term mental health was. And, you know, like as I started getting older and I just started reading more and, you know, reading more poets and reading more history books, you know, I realized, you know, that one thing that was missing growing up was the lack of truth that I was exposed to as a kid, you know, in regards to these situations that I was dealing with, right? Like nobody told me that my parents' drug addiction and poor decision-making that stemmed from that addiction was credited to their lack of opportunity and, you know, the access they were afforded in the communities they grew up in, right? Like nobody told me about the war on drugs or systemic oppression or mass incarceration, right? And, you know, I got arrested, you know, for things that I didn't do in Baltimore. And I got, you know, beat up by police officers in Baltimore, you know, when I didn't commit any crimes, and still I couldn't understand the concept of mass incarceration. So, you know, a lot of, you know, in my book, The Anti-Racism, I'm just teaching people more so how and why these troubled realities were created.
And when you interact with your students at Coppin, do you think they have a good understanding of this? Because many of them have come from backgrounds that are not too dissimilar from yours. I mean, how would you gauge the, you know, the resonance of those issues with the college students that you teach now?
So I would say that, you know, me being a student, you know, my entire life, you know, there were a lot of educators, you know, when I asked them, you know, why do I need this in life? You know, depending on the subject that's being taught. And they would just say things like, you just need it. You just need it. Right. And I feel like what I do different is, you know, because understanding the importance of literacy and literature and English, right, it's kind of like a luxury. It's not like, you know, you're not told this is one of the main principles that you need to understand to make it in this country, right? So what I try to do is get them to understand the importance of literacy and how, you know, understanding the importance of literacy can lead to critical thinking skills. And these critical thinking skills will not only help you do better in the classroom, but it will help you outside of the classroom, right? Like these are, you know, you'll learn how to make, you know, more efficient decisions, you know, when you're facing tough situations in life, right? So I feel like the main thing is, how do we teach students that these, you know, these classes and these courses and these books and these movies and these podcasts, everything that I'm teaching them, it will be effective in their real life. Like, I'm trying to teach them how to deal with life, how they must face it, and not some fairy tale world, you know, that, you know, traditionally educators, whether it's consciously or unconsciously, you know, that these educators traditionally, you know, miseducate, you know, Black and brown kids in this country, you know, because that's just what they're told to do, right? And at the end, it ends up, you know, just not having us prepared for the real world.
Yeah. And of course, the argument, you know, because I said so, is hardly ever. I can't think of any situation in which that's a valid argument. I mean, it may be how the person feels, but you got to defend your decision with something stronger than that. I want to listen to a little clip from this short documentary about you. It's called Hummingbirds in the Trenches.
Mm-hmm. Society begs us to pull up our bootstraps and fly to Venus, but keep us padlocked to trenches. It ain't easy to show our genius. The trade pound strikes one dome, deal trauma to 100 souls. Yoga and meditation can't stop blazing bullets from piercing through the livers of my niggas. Guns slither in broad day when lit off the light liquor. The pain that violence bring turn good cares to goodbyes. PTSD is prominent on this side. Revenge is sweeter than new nookie. You shoot your life away, a piece of pie. America ain't giving us no slice today. Give kids fentanyl to treat their nostrils. Tell me what are apostles, the kids who only go to church for funeral services. Most young hummingbirds in the trenches get their wings cut off or end up ODing like Basquiat. Imagine chasing your dreams, then your dreams run off.
That is powerful, man. Imagine chasing your dreams and your dreams run off. The connection that your work is having with the kids in the neighborhood that you grew up in and the neighborhoods like the one you grew up in. I know you're a good friend, and he's served as a mentor of sorts to you, D. Watkins, who writes in a similar vein, a different kind of style, but a similar vein. It does seem to me, you know, as a white guy looking at this from the outside, because I'm not in academia and you know, I'm not in the literary scene, that there is some renewed understanding and resonance with young people, young African American kids in Baltimore, about the power of the spoken word, about the power of telling the story of their lives and relating to the story of lives like yours, et cetera. Do you think that that's happening as well?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I believe that, you know, when we talking about storytelling, shifting the perspective and energy and representation, you know, of, you know, Black people and Black literature and how it exists, right? Like, it can't be addressed effectively without discussing two things. And I believe that's ownership and truth, right? Because the lack of truth is what I was saying earlier, like, is what allow racist ideas and falsehoods to be nourished and exist, right? Like, representation is allowing people to have full control over their heartbreak, their joyous moments, their pain, their loneliness, and so forth, right? Like, Toni Morrison is one of, you know, my favorite artists of all time. Like, I got her face and quote tatted on my arm, you know what I mean? And in her book, Sula, she has this one quote where she says, "Lonely, ain't it? Yes, but my lonely is mine. Now you're lonely as somebody else is made by somebody else and handed to you." Ain't that something?
Yeah.
A secondhand lonely? And the quote is powerful, especially in a world, in a country where, like, propaganda and racial conformity control a large majority of our actions, emotions, and ideas. So one of the main things that I be telling these students is, like, yo, like, understanding, you know, your story, your life, and, you know, interrogating it with the work that you read and the things that you write about your own life will help advance you in this world when it comes, you know, to the way that you are in relation to other people outside of you and also what's inside of you, right? So that's, like, another thing. And again, like, these things are important because a lot of people, it's a lot of people you can't ask that question to. You know, you can ask the question, who are you, right? Who are you?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people won't really know how to explain that, how to answer that question. So it's like through this work and through this understanding the importance of literacy and poetry, I'm trying to get them to understand their position in the world and what it means and just give them options, you know, because a lot of people don't have options of like what they want to do. It's like they got a pool of five things to pick from. They don't know it's really like 55. You know what I mean? But yeah. So,
and that's, you know, the thing. And the thing about literacy and the thing about literature and poetry, I mean, a phrase like a secondhand lonely, that is so powerful. That is so evocative. It's so right on and clear, you know. And you only experience that when you are experiencing the great genius of a Toni Morrison, you know. So you, it's not just thinking about how to write about yourself. It's being exposed to other people who are good at writing about themselves and working it. It's not something that comes super easily, right? I mean, it takes some work.
It does.
Yeah. Let's listen to another little clip from, this is from your EP, and this is a piece called I Will Tell Them.
Since all of our lives are already planned out, there was an expiration date on your sobriety that only God knew, that I wish he could have prepped me for. For too many moons, America has been lying to black children. So if any of your kids, my younger siblings, ever come to me and ask what was life like growing up, I will tell them the truth. Some days the pendulum will swing in your favor, and on others it will swing in the favor of your opposite. And every time God gives you a gift, even if it's a smile on your worst days, pocket it, save it, put it in a safe place, deposit it. Make sure you only have access, because your happiness should only be handled by you. Don't give your happiness to a soul, because what happens when they touch it, when they drop it or they crush it? They will trade it for likes and cheap retweets. They will drag your happiness through the streets, I promise you. They will. I will tell them, at times I used to sit alone and wonder, how does it feel to carry burnt glass tubes stuffed with still war and pills of dope in the same purse where you keep pictures of your children, your boys and girls, in the same company of the boy and girl. I will tell them, in this family, addiction gets handed over like hand-me-down coats, too big, but you wear it on your shoulder blades, burdens, so heavy that you hunchback, so mean that you mug, Biggie give me the loot before I shoot, bad boys be the family, I ignored the voices that tried to keep.
And there's lots more where that came from. That's from Kondwami Fidel's poetry EP, The Mud Was Made For Us, a piece called I Will Tell Them. So, Kondwami, tell me about the performance art aspect of your work. How has that evolved? Because it's one thing to write the poetry. It's another thing to perform it for audiences or to put it on an EP like that, to choose the tracks that are going to be under your voice. In our last minute or two here, tell us about how that process works.
Honestly, you know, I know what I like. You know, I love jazz. I love rap music. You know, and it's just like a mix of both of those things. And, you know, I just got to feel it. Like everything that I love in life, it had, like, I've realized that, like, my love language, as in regards to people, as in regards to things, as in regards to music, sound, what I like, you know, as far as reading books, right? I got to feel it. It just got to be something, you know, that I can't really, put into words, right? Is it something I just feel inside of me, like this is it, right? Or like, you know, that's pretty much it.
And when you do live shows, do you know? I mean, are you getting the energy from the audience the way a musician does or a dancer does?
So somebody asked me the other day. They was like, you know, where does my most like joyous moments, or like what are my moments of freedom when like creating art? Is it reading? Is it coming up with ideas? Is it, you know, putting it down on the paper? And, you know, my best versions of myself is when I'm on stage and I'm performing. Like, I feel like it's the only time in life where I have control over everything. I feel like it's the best version of myself. you know, sometimes, you know, I feel like I'm not the best speaker, or sometimes I even feel like I'm not the best writer. You know what I mean? But I feel like when I go up there, you know, it's like a little shaky in the beginning. I get a little nervous. But when I lock in and zone in, it's like I'm just in a room by myself and I just get free. Like I use those moments, like, you know, how, you know, people, everybody got those moments when they feel free to say, like they go to the woods and they cut their phone off, or some people find it in church when they had a Holy Ghost. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like these are my moments. Like this is where I seek, you know, the best refuge is on stage when I'm performing. And, you know, That's why.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's well said. Well said. Because, you know, in finding that moment, finding that place where you really are your true self and you're most free, is a really important part of any artist's life, as well as the important part of anybody, even when they're not in the creative process. The poet and writer Kondwani Fidel. The EP is called The Mud Was Made for Us. His recent book is called The Anti-Racist: How to Start the Conversation About Race and Take Action. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it, man. Happy Thanksgiving.
Definitely. Thank you. Enjoy your holidays.
Thank you. Coming up on Midday on Poetry, we will continue with Grace Cavalieri, the poet laureate of the state of Maryland. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1. WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My next guest is the poet, playwright, and writer Grace Cavalieri, who has served as Maryland's Poet Laureate since 2018. She is the author of 26 books and chapbooks of poetry, and she's had more than 24 plays produced in theaters across the country. She is also the founder of The Poet and the Poem, a radio show and podcast that she has hosted for 44 years. It is currently available through the Library of Congress. And Grace Cavalieri joins us on Zoom from Annapolis. Grace, how are you doing?
Hey, Tom. Poetry loves you. I just want you to know that. Poetry loves Tom Hall.
Well, I got to tell you, I love poetry, too. We don't get a chance to talk about it a lot. I was delighted to finally get a chance to talk to Kondwani Fidel.
Wasn't that exciting?
You know, I mean, he's part of a great movement that's going on here. Yeah.
You want to check him out? I will meet him.
Yeah.
I will.
Yeah. I mean, how's the pandemic, for example, do you think affected the literary scene in Maryland and the poem scene, the poetry scene in particular?
Good question. You'd be very surprised to find that it was very favorable for poetry, because everyone was on Zoom. I could have groups with people from the Eastern Shore, from Montgomery, Maryland, Montgomery County. I could have the whole state on a Zoom. So this was really profitable. I have 5 poetry groups that met constantly, and a lot of flourishing, a lot of new thinking. I have one group I'm very proud of, 6 women who were extremely accomplished women in other fields who had never tried their hands at poetry. We met every Friday on Zoom. These women did everything. They showed up. They did the ode. They did the villanelle, the ghazal, the haibun. And I published a book. So now we have a book of women who had never written before and have quite an accomplished set of poetry. I wanted to publish their first writings because, as I say, they had the courage to try. And the book is called The Song in the Room. And that is just so, that couldn't have happened, Tom, without the COVID, because the room is the Zoom, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We were all, you put 2 people in a room, you have drama. You put 6 people in a room, you can really get some energy. So Zoom has profited me very well.
What do you think drew them to poetry at this time?
Very interesting, Tom. Each of these women have had a rich life. One is a musician, one is a lawyer, one is a journalist, one is a graphics designer. They had already been accomplished in their fields. Now, when you get at a certain age, you want to keep beginning. We want to begin again. And that is the vitality that comes with being 60 and over. And so they knew what they could do. They wanted to see what they couldn't do. and they really, really have, they show up. I don't even have to be at the meetings, I think, anymore. They've got it. So they'll be meeting again this with a haibun and a haiku this week.
Grace Cavalieri is the poet laureate of Maryland. Her latest books are The Secret Letters of Madame de Stael and Grace Art, Poems and Paintings. It's Midday on Poetry. I'm Tom Hall. If you have a question for our poet laureate, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. So, Grace, I wonder if the pandemic has occasioned a sort of renewed interest in introspection and thought about, you know, meaning and fulfillment and being gratified. We hear about the great resignation, people deciding, you know, this job just doesn't do it for me, so I'm going to take a leap of faith and I'm going to quit. Maybe I'll find another job, maybe I won't, but it's a scary thing to just all of a sudden say, I'm going to walk away from my income. But I wonder if, you know, the pandemic has made people think more about those things, those sort of higher values. And then the obvious next step then is to express what those values are. And of course, poetry is one of the great ways historically that people have done that.
Tom, that is just the right question, because I think people, when they were confined, they found that solitude was not loneliness, that they had nothing but an interior life then. And I think it has been a boom to a spiritual life. Now, before the COVID, I was traveling the state of Maryland working with teenagers because poetry was showing them they had an interior life. That is something that teens didn't know about. They were wired outward, you know, and they discovered who they were through poetry. However, in the pandemic, the same thing happened. And we were forced then into solitude, and people wanted to start experimenting. I started painting, for example, I who have no talent whatsoever. And it allowed us time, you know. It even allowed people to go into almost a Zen part of themselves where there was no noise, no outside noise. I do wish the pandemic would be over. You know that. But if we have to have something that is a curse, well, flowers will still bloom. And they did. And art prospered. It is really a miracle.
I want to ask you about this book, The Secret Letters of Madame de Stael. You've written a number of books where you focus on particular women. Who was Madame de Stael, and why did you decide to take her up as a project?
Thank you. Madame is happy to be noted. Madame de Stael was the most prominent writer in the 18th century. Now, this is very important because nobody knows who she is. I find that fascinating. This woman wrote 40 books, political treatises. She is the one that unseated Napoleon. She was such a political force that she absolutely was in favor of the coup and spread this through France. This woman was so profound as a salon leader. All the intellectuals gathered to her house. Why do we not know her? Because women have been eclipsed by history. And my thing is, finding a woman, falling in love with that woman, entering the psychosis, and bringing it to light. Mary Wollstonecraft was my first obsession from 1975 to one of the first books on her in the early 2000s. Harriet Powers, the ex-slave quilt maker whose quilt hangs in the Smithsonian, no one knew who she was. And the Smithsonian commissioned me to find her life. Then Anna Nicole Smith, who everyone may know as a bimbo, but she needed vindicating. And I saw that she could have been something different. And so I wrote a play after the book of poems, which gave her a new ending. I didn't make her the drug-filled buffoon. I gave her a happy ending. I gave her a husband who was a doctor, a baby. And it was in New York, called Anna Nicole Blonde Glory. So writers don't make any money, but they can change the narrative. And I love that.
And the narrative that you came up with for Madame de Staël, how did you imagine this book? What is actually in the book? Because I find the premise of this book fascinating.
Thank you. First of all, if you don't like French history, you can look at the pictures, because Dan Morano is a world-class photographer who furnished the pictures of Versailles. Madame de Staël was born in 1776. She was an aristocrat. She was with the court of Marie Antoinette. She was married to a man she did not love, but that suited her well, so she could get on with her writing. She had every lover there was to have who was in high places. You know, Talleyrand, a baby by Talleyrand, Benjamin Constant, you know, Louis Nordone, every single man of letters or of politics she had an affair with. In those days, aristocracy was given a great latitude and people were allowed to conduct themselves without morality, really. So she had a baby by a couple of people and her own husband. But all this time, she's writing books. I don't know how she found the time. Household help, I imagine. But this woman has changed literature forevermore. Her novels had divorce in them, which in the 18th century was unheard of. And she literally changed the face of literature. So why don't we know her? If you look up 18th century writers, you find Rousseau, you find Godwin, you find Burke. Nobody knows Madame de Staël. So the one thrill I have, Tom, is that people say, I didn't know her before. That is the most beautiful phrase I've ever heard.
Yeah, they know her now, because it's a fascinating concept. And the photographs are beautiful of Versailles. Anybody who's ever been there knows it's a beautiful place. I wonder, do you have your Grace Art book with you?
I do.
Could I ask you to read a poem, and can I be so horrid as to pick one myself rather than ask you to pick one? Do you mind?
Oh, what page?
Page 14. It's a poem called Beyond Its Possibilities. You were talking about the difference and the distinction between loneliness and solitude that you talk about with the kids you were working with pre-COVID. And we should mention that this book, or you can explain what the relationship is between the poems and the paintings in this book.
Oh,
they're
Tom,
both beautiful.
You amaze me. You actually read this.
I'm telling you,
people really read poetry. I can't believe it. Well, this book is a series of about 30 of my paintings. I have about 50 hanging in houses all over America now, just because I just thought everyone can try everything they want. So I was asked to do the illustrations for a wonderful book of poems by Herbert Martin about a man who was dying of AIDS. And the painting is called Diagnosis. And I chose poems that really weren't illustrating the paintings, but they had a tiny thread that might connect. And the poem is called Beyond Its Possibilities. Loneliness is not exactly solitude. Solitude is not exactly loneliness. As each presses forward into the other, chased by a conference of philosophical opinions, under the weight of perhaps too much thought. Let us say rather what feelings are let flying all at once in the flinty gray of dawn. Well, that's the way I'd rather go in any garden of discussion. What rises high in the heart and falls low unexpectedly without management, and what coexists with surprise.
That's so beautiful.
Thank you so much.
And, you know, it's interesting, the juxtaposition of your paintings, and then I guess there's some paintings from other people, and the poems is a fascinating way to confront the poetry in a way that Kandwani Fidel uses music. A sort of bed of sound that he reads his poetry over. I mean, that juxtaposition, I think is really, I mean, in the way a curator in a museum says, well, this painting should go next to this one, and that one should go next to that one, in very, you know, careful and strategic and purposeful way. It's interesting that you've paired these poems with these particular paintings, which are reproduced beautifully in the book. So we have a caller, actually, and we just have a few minutes. So let's see if we can get to the caller, to Michael, who's on the line from Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Grace Cavalieri.
Hi. Many of us are really in awe of these 20 to 30 books of poetry that Grace has published and that she's the poet laureate. But could she comment briefly on, she's done 20 or 30 plays, many of which were done in early Baltimore theater going back to the 1960s. Could she comment on herself as a playwright and the scene in Baltimore then?
Oh, that is Michael Makarovich. Is it not, Michael?
It is.
My first director, 1966, the Corner Theater Cafe in Baltimore. My very first play, What Shall We Do Yesterday? Michael was fresh out of Towson, a brilliant director, and he produced the most exciting experimental play I've ever had done. So I'm thrilled to hear his voice again. He really gave me the baton and said, here, go ahead with it. And my first play ever produced. Baltimore had a thriving, were you born in 1966, Tom?
I was okay. I was 11 years old.
Well, oh my. Well, we now know. But we had a storefront theater and then one on top of a dentist's office, which was one of the first of the Cultural Revolution in theater in Baltimore. And it really was something, Tom.
Yeah. And we now have a really wonderful, thriving theater scene here in Baltimore, not just the big theaters, Center Stage and Everyman Theater, the Equity Theaters, but, you know, groups like Single Carrot and, you know, there's just so many others that have, you know, really made a mark. So, and it's great, you know, that you have been part of that scene for a long time. Grace Cavalieri, she is the Poet Laureate of Maryland. Her latest books are called Grace Art, Poems and Painting, and The Secret Letters of Madame de Stael. Thank you so much, Grace. I really appreciate it. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Tom, you've given me a beautiful Thanksgiving, and poetry too. Thank you.
That's it for us today. Tomorrow, it's our annual pre-Thanksgiving edition of What You Got Cookin'. John Shields from Gertrude's Restaurant, Damian Mosley from Black Sauce Kitchen, and Debonette Wyatt of a new restaurant called My Mama's Vegan. They will join me to talk turkey and to talk not having turkey if you're a vegan, and they'll share ideas to make your Thanksgiving dinner the best it can be. So I encourage you to put your apron on, pull up to the counter, turn on your radio, and start getting ready for Thanksgiving tomorrow here on Midday. Would love to hear from you about your favorite recipes, about your favorite traditions, about what you're going to be doing this Thanksgiving, particularly given what we couldn't do last Thanksgiving. Coming up now, it's Here and Now. That's up on the way after the news. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for being with us. I really appreciate it. Have a great day.
You're listening to 88.1 WYPR.